Hey guys, welcome back to the Thrillogy podcast. My name is Cameron and I'm here with my two co-hosts.
I'm Krista.
And I'm Morgan.
So I have a pretty big announcement to share with our Thrillogy listeners. As of today, we officially have surpassed 600 total plays across our episodes, which is so insane. Thank you guys so much for your continued support and for coming back each week for your dose of all things Thrillogy. As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts and feedback, and you can do that by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps us out and helps more people discover all things Thrillogy, and we'd even be happy to shout you out on both our social media and in our next episode.
And that being said, I want to give a shout out to Saint Maiden 1256, who left us an amazing Apple Podcast review and asked some great questions about episode 11, the case of Anita Knutson. Unfortunately, this is one of those cases that didn't have too much information available online, so I don't have the answer to their first question, which was, how old was the custodian? However, they also asked if the neighbors were interviewed during the investigation, and the answer is yes. Hundreds of neighbors were interviewed, and that's actually how they identified the runner who was a suspect for a moment before being cleared. The commenter also asked if the boyfriend was a large man, which, again, I'm not quite sure, but I do know, and it's worth mentioning, that Anita was a very petite woman. And lastly, I just want to say that this commenter also had a great theory, and their theory was that they believed that this was a male assailant because they said, you know, this person needed to be strong to overpower Anita and to use the dull pocket knife against her.
Thanks again for that amazing review, but for now, let's move on to today's case, the case of the Somerton Man. Today's case is about the Somerton Man, sometimes referred to as the Tammin Should case, and later you guys will find out why it has that nickname. But this case in particular is also considered to be one of Australia's most profound mysteries. On December 1st, 1948, at 6:30 a.m., police were contacted after a man's body was discovered on Somerton Park Beach near Glenelg in South Australia. The man was found lying on the sand with his head resting against the seawall, his legs extended and his feet crossed, and due to the positioning of his body, police initially believed that he was asleep when he died. Upon further searching, investigators also found an unlit cigarette, a second-class rail ticket from Adelaide to Henley Beach, a bus ticket from the city that didn't look to be used, a U.S.-manufactured comb, half a pack of Juicy Fruit gum, a pack of cigarettes, and a box of matches. The man was also dressed in a white shirt, a red, white, and blue tie, brown pants, a brown knitted pullover, and a fashionable gray and brown double-breasted jacket of what they reported as American tailoring. Now, very similarly to a case I had covered just a few weeks ago, all of the labels on his clothes had actually been completely removed. And police even noted that he had no hat, which might not sound too weird, but it was pretty unusual for 1948. And finally, he had no wallet, making him impossible to identify. After testing dental records in hope of finding a match, police were unable to match him to any known person. An autopsy was performed, and they determined his time of death was approximately 2 a.m. on December 1st. Now, during the autopsy, medical examiners were able to show that his last meal was a pasty, eaten 3 to 4 hours before his death. But tests also failed to reveal any sort of foreign substance in his body. However, the pathologist, Dr. Dwyer, concluded, quote, "I am quite convinced the death could not have been natural. The poison I suggested was our barbiturate or a soluble hypnotic," unquote. Although poisoning remained the prime cause of death, the pasty was not believed to be the source, and other than that, the coroner was unable to reach a conclusion as to the man's identity, his cause of death, and whether the man had been seen alive by supposed witnesses at Somerton Beach on the evening of November 30th. Since police were unable to identify the man, his body was then embalmed, and a police commented that this was the first time they ever had to do such a thing because they just couldn't figure out who this guy was. Later witnesses would come forward to say that on the evening of November 30th, they had actually seen an individual resembling the Somerton man lying on his back in the same spot, in the same position where his body would later be found. Now, at first, you might think, oh, these people saw him when he was already dead. And that was my first thought, too. However, a couple who said they saw him at around 7 p.m. on November 30th noted that they saw him extend his right arm to the fullest extent and then just drop it limply, implying that he was indeed still alive. And as we know, the autopsy confirmed his likely time of death was in the early morning of December 1st.
That's so interesting that they remember seeing him extend his arm. Like, that's so specific.
Right. That's kind of what I thought, too. But at the same time, I was thinking about it. And if I was on a beach and I saw somebody just laying there still, like not really moving, and they, can you imagine, they just lift their arm up like to the fullest extent and then just drop it down? I mean, I don't know that, I don't know how long I would remember, but I'd be like, okay, that's kind of weird.
That's true, especially if they were worried that he was dead or something.
Right.
Yeah, I've definitely done like double takes to people in the city that are overly still on the sidewalk just to make sure. So you kind of do take like a mental picture. I mean, it gets erased shortly after because it happens so much, but
yeah,
you definitely do make sure. So maybe that's what it was.
On the other hand, though, another couple saw him between 7:30 and 8 p.m., remembering the time specifically because the streetlights had just turned on. Now, this couple never actually saw him move, but they did mention that during this time period, his position had changed, or at least they thought it did, meaning that they looked at him, looked away, and when they looked back at him, they could have sworn that he had moved. They also thought it was strange that he wasn't reacting at all to all of the mosquitoes that were on the beach at the time, and honestly, they assumed that he was either drunk or asleep, and they just didn't really get any closer to investigate. This would definitely be strange if he was still alive, but perhaps at this time he was already suffering some sort of effects from being poisoned, assuming that we go along with the theory that the medical examiner shared that he was poisoned.
Also, Cameron, I'm sorry, I just have a question, maybe for the American listeners. Is a pasty a pastry?
I believe so.
Okay, just wanted to clear that up. All right,
yeah. Cool. Later in 1959, 11 years after the man was discovered, another witness actually came forward, and he reported to the police that he and three others had seen a well-dressed man, but this time the well-dressed man was carrying another man on his shoulders along Somerton Park Beach the night before the body was found. But again, this was 11 years later, so the validity of this statement, who really knows? Again, like I said, this case has yet another similarity to the Easdal woman case that we covered a few weeks ago. On January 14th, 1949, just a month or so after the body had been discovered, staff at the Adelaide Railway Station discovered a brown suitcase with its label removed that had been checked into the station's cloakroom after 11 a.m. on November 30th, 1948. It was believed that the suitcase belonged to the man on the beach because of the timing, witness reports, the lack of any label. But even more strange was that the suitcase contained a thread card of Barber-branded orange wax thread that was not available in Australia at the time, and it was even the same type of thread that was used to repair the lining in a pocket of the Somerton man's pants. Like I said, all identification marks on the clothes had been removed, but police found the name T. Keen on a tie, Keen on a laundry bag, and Keen on a singlet, along with three dry cleaning marks. Now, one thing that I do want to point out is that the final Keen on the laundry bag is actually spelled differently than the first two. The first two are K-E-A-N-E, and the last one is just K-E-A-N. Police believe that whoever removed the clothing tags either overlooked these three items or maybe even purposely left the Keen tags on the clothes, knowing that Keen was not the dead man's name. As you both know, the 40s and 50s were difficult periods of time for many countries around the world, and in Australia, wartime rationing was still being enforced. Because of this, clothing was really difficult to acquire, and so with many people buying secondhand clothing, it wasn't too uncommon for the tags to be removed as to not continue to use clothes that have somebody else's name on them. But then that leads us back to the first question. Why would only some of the tags be removed? After an exhaustive search, it was concluded that there was no T. Keen missing in any English-speaking country. The dry cleaning marks were also investigated, but ultimately led to nothing. All that could be concluded from the suitcase was that the stitching on one of the coats found in the case indicated that it had been manufactured in the United States. And this particular coat had not been imported to Australia, indicating that the man had to have either been to the United States or bought the coat from somebody of a similar size who had been to the US.
So I just have a question. Originally, when I heard the scene of the alleged crime, I kind of was picturing him as a vagrant, but is he like maybe some type of professional, or we don't know yet?
Yeah, he was well dressed. Like his clothes were nicely ironed. Like he had nice clothes. You know, it didn't, he wasn't wearing anything that would make you think, oh, this man is, you know, like living or sleeping on the beach. He looked very nicely dressed up. And actually, kind of in that same vein, I'll get into it in just a second, but it just goes to show that he was even more clean than you might be imagining. So after checking incoming train records, police believe that the man had arrived at the Adelaide Railway Station by overnight train, and he probably came from either Melbourne, Sydney, or Port Augusta. Now, kind of like what I was saying, based on his body that was found, they speculated that he had showered and shaved at the adjacent city baths, which, although it might kind of sound like a public showering facility, were really just public swimming pools. And he likely did this before returning to purchase a ticket for the 10:50 a.m. train to Henley Beach, which we know, for whatever reason, he did not catch, or maybe just decided not to take it. So again, he was recently showered and shaved, so not somebody you would think that would be living on the beach or homeless or anything like that. A second investigation into the Somerton man's death was conducted by coroner Thomas Cleland and was initially started a few days after the body's discovery, but was then adjourned until June 17th, 1949. Cleland re-examined the body and made a number of discoveries. He first noted that the man's shoes were remarkably clean and appeared to have been recently polished, rather than the condition that you would probably expect of somebody who had been, apparently, wandering around the city all day. He added that this evidence fit in with the theory that the body may have been brought to Somerton Park Beach after the man's death, accounting for the lack of vomit and, you know, anything that might have been left over from convulsions, which are the two main reactions to somebody who might have been poisoned, which, again, this is assuming that he really was poisoned. The medical examiner also speculated that since none of the witnesses saw the man up close, they couldn't possibly identify the man without a shadow of a doubt. And as such, the possibility that he was later brought to the beach still could be possible. Professor of Physiology and Pharmacology at the University of Adelaide, Cedric Hicks, testified that there are a group of drugs that are extremely toxic in small doses, but would be extremely difficult or nearly impossible to find in an autopsy. Hicks also stated that if death had occurred 7 hours after the man was last seen to move, it would imply a massive dose that could still have been undetectable. So even though people on the beach claim to have saw him moving at around 7, 8 p.m., it's still very possible that he was poisoned, and that even though it was such a huge dose that wouldn't kill him until 2 a.m., still be untraceable. And furthermore, if the witnesses really did see the same man that was later found, the movement seen at 7 p.m. could have easily been one of his last convulsions preceding death. At the end of the second investigation, though, the cause of death was still a complete mystery, and really no conclusions could be made. Now, at around the same time as the second investigation, a tiny piece of rolled up paper with the words Tamman Should printed on it was found in a secret pant pocket of the Somerton man, and this is why the case is sometimes referred to as the Tamman Should case. Local public library officials were called in to translate the text, which was identified as a phrase meaning ended or finished, and it was found on the last page of the Rubaiyat book. Police conducted an Australia-wide search to find a copy of the book that had a similarly blank reverse side, and a photograph of the scrap of paper was released to the press. Following this public appeal by police, the copy of Rubaiyat from which the page had been torn, and they knew that it was from the same book because it was confirmed after testing the pages, the tear marks, and so on, it was located. And most of the accounts actually say that the book was found in an unlocked car parked on Jetty Road in Glenelg, which is the same place where the body was found, either on the rear floor well or on the back seat.
Also, I just want to point out that in case anyone doesn't know, it seems that the Rubaiyat is like a book of poems.
Exactly. So I'm going to kind of get into it and tell you guys a little bit about what the book is about, just to give you guys some background.
All right, cool.
The theme of this book is that one should live life to the fullest and have no regrets when it ends. And just like you said, it's a book of poems. The poem's subject matter led police to eventually theorize that the man had committed suicide, but it's kind of uncertain whether this is because of the book's subject matter or if up until this point it was widely accepted that he was poisoned and maybe he did it to himself. And even weirder, and again, similar to one of our other cases, there was something written in code in the back of the book. However, unlike some other stuff in this story that we'll get to, this code, to this day, has never been cracked. Now, in addition to the mysterious code, there was also a phone number belonging to a nurse, Jessica Ellen Jo Thompson, who, get this, only lived about 1,300 feet from where the Somerton man's body was found. When interviewed by police, Thompson said that she did not know who the dead man was, and she didn't know why he would have her phone number and why he would choose to visit her suburb on the night of his death. With that said, she did report, though, that at some time in late 1948, an unidentified man had attempted to visit her when she wasn't home and even went as far as asking one of her neighbors for more information on her. Gary Feltis, an author who wrote a book about the Somerton man, had actually interviewed Thompson back in 2002. He stated that he found that she was either being evasive or just didn't want to talk about it when asked about the mysterious man. But it wasn't just in his interview that Thompson had a strange reaction. Back when the body was originally discovered, police had actually made a head and shoulder cast, kind of like a mold, to assist in the future of the investigation. And when Thompson was shown this cast, reports say that she was taken aback, didn't want to look at it, and even appeared as if she was about to faint. And again, even more interestingly, it wasn't until Feltis wrote and published the book that her real name became public. Back in 1949, Jessica Thompson actually requested that police not keep a permanent record of her name or release any of her details to third parties, and they agreed. As you both can imagine, this definitely hindered later investigation since, in the police reports, she was only known by fake names. Now, once again, there are some striking similarities between the Somerton man and the Easdal woman when it comes to theories, specifically the theory that they were both spies. As I mentioned before, this case is from the late 40s, right after the Second World War. And again, just like the Easdal woman, this man seemed to have been completely unknown, mysterious, and consistently removed tags and other traces of his identity. Additionally, at least two sites relatively close to Adelaide were of interest to potential spies. The first one was the Radium Hill Uranium Mine and the Woomera Test Range, an Anglo-Australian military research facility. The man's death also coincided with the reorganization of Australian security agencies, which would eventually culminate the following year, and it led to the founding of the Australian Security Intelligence Organization. And finally, this would also be followed by a crackdown on Soviet espionage in Australia, which was revealed by intercepts of Soviet communications under the Venona Project. Again, even more recently, in 2013, Thompson's daughter Kate stated in a TV interview with Channel 9 60 Minutes that she genuinely believed her mother knew the man. Kate also stated that her mother Jessica had told her that she had lied to the police. Jessica did know the identity of the Somerton man, and his identity was also, quote, known to a level higher than the police force, unquote. She suggested that her mother and the Somerton man may have both been spies, noting that Jessica Thompson, her mother, taught English to migrants, was interested in communism, and could speak Russian, although she would not disclose to her daughter where she had learned it or why. So, knowing this would definitely lead back to the spy theory. Without adding too many more names to the mix, Kate, which is Jessica's daughter that we've been talking about in the 60 Minutes episode, she also has a brother, and her brother's name is Robin. Now, Robin's wife, Roma, and their daughter, Rachel Egan, they actually both also appeared on the 60 Minute episode. So this would be Kate's niece and sister-in-law. When they appeared on the 60 Minutes episode, they actually suggested that the Somerton man was Robin's father, and therefore Rachel's grandfather.
So you're saying that Jessica and the Somerton man could have had a child out of wedlock?
Exactly. And that would have been Robin. And so Kate would be Robin's half-sister, technically.
Gotcha. Okay, because that's funny, because like the whole time when we were talking about him potentially stopping by her home before he like passed, I was getting the vibe that he was actually Jessica's father, like maybe trying to like outreach one more time, especially if they were trying to see if he committed suicide, like a last-ditch effort. I mean, I don't know the need to be so mysterious, but that was like my immediate vibe. So it's actually funny that I was close, potentially. Yeah.
I mean, it was also 1948. So like this definitely wasn't as normal as it is today. So he could have been trying to keep it, you know, on the down low so that people wouldn't find out. Who knows?
So this is all making sense to me now, because when you said Jessica didn't want her identity even in the police report, that was a little strange to me. But bringing up, you know, the theory that she had a lover, that kind of makes sense. And also, you know, it's funny that she was so adamant about not knowing who this man was, and that she had no idea. But it makes sense, especially during that time period, that she would want to keep it as discreet and under wraps as possible.
Yeah. And this isn't even, so this is another thing that might kind of convince you guys even more that the Somerton man is Robin's father. So there is, and it's really hard to kind of demonstrate this in a podcast because obviously we're an audio only podcast, but there is a part of the ear where there's kind of the inside of your ear, there is a particular shape. And depending on that shape, it's something that's genetic, and it's something like only like it's a very, very low percentage of the population like actually has that gene where that part of the ear is shaped that way. And both Robin and the Somerton man both have that same shaped ear. Additionally, it's also very rare that people don't have their incisors in their teeth, right? Normally you have your front teeth, your incisors, and then you have your like your canine teeth, right? Neither Robin nor the Somerton man have their incisors either. So there are two really rare genetic traits that both of them share. And I believe when I was researching this case, it was reported that the chances of these two not being related and sharing these two same traits would be something like between 10 and 20 million. So very, very rare.
Do we have any DNA from the man? Like, is it possible to test them?
So that's a very good question. So the Egans actually tried to get permission from the attorney general to have the Somerton man's body exhumed and the DNA tested, right? Because it seems like everything's falling into place. Now, strangely, Kate Thompson, so Jessica's daughter, she actually opposed to having his body exhumed. And she said it would be disrespectful to her brother Robin if the man really was his father. Now, as interest in this case resurfaced in October of 2011, the attorney general actually denied exhuming the body, stating that there needs to be public interest reasons that go well beyond public curiosity or broad scientific interest. However, in October of 2019, Attorney General Vicky Chapman actually granted the approval for his body to be exhumed in order to extract DNA for analysis. And finally, as recently as May 19th of 2021, his body was successfully exhumed and his DNA is planned to be compared to a potential granddaughter, which I can only imagine would be Rachel Egan, to see if it's a match. So with all of that said, what are your guys' thoughts? Who do you think this mysterious Somerton man was? Or I guess even better, what do you think actually happened to him and why?
Yeah, I think after going through everything, I am definitely leaning toward that he was Jessica's lover. And that would also give us a motive, right? You know, her husband sure. poisoned him. So I don't know. That's just what I thought after going through everything.
Sure.
Well, I do find that the note in his pocket is very interesting. The one that translates to like ending or something. Because it goes, you know, hand in hand again with, like, unfortunately, the suicide theory, which would go hand in hand with, like I said, him stopping by, maybe trying to make the last amends with whatever had happened. But also, I mean, he could be a target with the same note in his pocket.
Sure.
You know, like, hits, like organized hits, whether in this era it was like a KGB thing or like even mafia stuff, they leave like signs to mess with the next person. Like, if you do this to us, this is what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, I mean, it was a secret pocket, but I'm wondering if it could be something like that. The genetic stuff definitely is really interesting with like how your ear kind of has almost like a fingerprint and the fact that it's so unique. So that's really interesting. I'm happy that you keep picking these cases that have recent updates, because maybe we'll learn something.
Yeah, I know. And it's actually crazy too, because I've heard about this case before. I've listened to the podcast episodes before. I think, honestly, out of all the episodes that we've done, I think probably this one and the Easdal woman one have been the two probably most popular cases that we've covered. But interestingly, in all of the podcast episodes or YouTube videos that I've listened to, they're all a little bit older and they don't share the newest updates. And so very similarly to some of our older cases, I didn't actually expect an update in this case until I was researching and I'm like, oh my God, this is really recent. This is of May of this year. So it's awesome for us though, because obviously we're kind of giving you the most updated story, but we can also post a little bonus episode if, you know, when we do find something. I'm definitely on the side that there was some sort of secret affair. Now, one thing I'd be curious to hear your guys' kind of point of view on it. There are some theories that believe that not only was it an affair between Jessica and the Somerton man, but that it was an affair between two spies, which might also explain why, you know, he removed all of his tags, didn't have any identification, why Jessica, like, you know, said she didn't know him, had no idea who he was. Because if both of them are spies, and even more so if they work for different people, they might not want people to know that they intermingled or like form this relationship. Obviously, that'd be very frowned upon if your profession is being a spy. It's also hard for me to overlook the fact that, you know, what Kate was saying about her mom, that her mom was really interested in communism, that her mom, which for what we know is just this normal Australian woman, but for some reason is speaking Russian and like never told her daughter why or how she speaks Russian. Obviously her name, you know, Jessica Thompson, is not a Russian name either. So I don't know. There's definitely something about that that strikes me as odd, but I don't know. It's a very interesting case. And I really do hope that we have some answers soon with the DNA and hopefully answers that tell us who he was and what actually maybe happened. Thank you everyone for listening and for joining us today. You can find all photos and sources for this case on our website, trilogypodcast.com. And we'd love to hear what you think. Let us know on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook or any of our social media networks. Let us know what you think and who you think the Somerton man is.
We release new episodes every Monday, and each week we post two clues leading up to our next episode. The first clue is, I spy with my little eye. Please be sure to check out our Instagram for the second clue later this week.
Thanks again for listening, and as always, you can keep up with all things Thrillogy on social media at @ThrillogyPod and make story requests on thrillogypodcast.com.